Your next promotion is within your control, and this podcast shows you how to get there. Welcome to episode number 130. Today's episode, I have a very special treat for you. I am interviewing world-renowned author Katrine Markall. Katrine is an absolutely phenomenal thought leader and the author of Mother of Invention. In today's conversation, we are getting raw and real about how to bring more women into the quote unquote conversation. You guys are absolutely going to love this. Let's get started.
Welcome to Maximize Your Career with Stacey Mayer, a podcast about achieving your career goals while also being yourself.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Maximize Your Career. I'm your host, Stacey Mayer, and super excited to be here with you this week. I have an extra special guest for you today. You are going to be so excited to meet her. I met Katrine actually a couple of years ago as she was a colleague in a group mastermind that I was a part of. And you've probably heard about Eleanor Beaton. She wrote the foreword of my book. And every single woman that is in that program, I'm like, I need to be a part of their world. And Katrine definitely is at the top of that list. And I have been trying to get her on this podcast, but she's very busy traveling the world. She's an international woman speaking about women in economics. And I'm just so thrilled to have her on here today to share with you her point of view and the history and the work that she has done through economics and her work as a journalist. And I am just so thrilled. Thank you, Katrine, for being here.
Thank you. I'm thrilled.
Let me give you a more formal introduction and then we'll just dive right into our conversation today. Katrine Markall is a best-selling author on women in innovation. Her first book, Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner, has been translated into more than 20 languages. Katrine's second book, Mother of Invention, How Good Ideas Get Ignored in an Economy Built for Men, became a bestseller in Sweden in 2020 and has been published in several languages over the past year. She lives in the English countryside with her husband and three children. I'm so, so excited to have you here with us. Let's just dive in. What do you feel like is your secret to success?
Oh, that is a big question. I think for me, it is actually realizing what I'm good at and sort of having the courage to lean into that. And for me, that has been my writing. And I mean, when I wrote Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner, I was in my 20s and it was this crazy idea. I was a financial journalist in Sweden covering the financial crisis. And I just had this idea, oh, there should be a book sort of about feminist economics and how economics forgot about women. And it just felt like this little narrow book I was writing on this narrow topic. And I did it. And then I got this idea that that should sort of probably be read outside of Sweden because Sweden is a small country. And just for some reason, I had the tenacity to sort of pursue that. And now, 10 years later, sort of Margaret Atwood endorsed it and it's out in 20 languages. And it's just this magical thing. I mean, you and I were talking about that before you hit record here with your book, and that books are, they're so amazing. It's this such an old medium, but they have this enormous power. When you put something into a book, you make, you know, a couple of ideas and take them and you turn them into a book, they get this life, you know, if you're lucky, and they sort of take you out into the world. And they certainly, this book really took me out into the world. And this message, I still, you know, still 10 years later, I get letters from readers about this book. So yeah,
it's,
I don't
so
know if that
important.
Answered your question.
Yes, absolutely. Because what I see in you is this embrace of your own personal experience and things that happened to you as a female journalist, specifically in the world of economics, and your own ideas, and then really putting that and translating that to a book form. And you're such a brilliant storyteller as well, right? So much of what you're doing is so relatable, but also challenging. in a relatable way, right? So it's not polarizing. That's another thing that I really love about the work that you do, where you're very frank, you're very honest, but you're not really saying anything negative. You're just like, this is the history, folks.
Yes, yes. And I try to be funny as well, which I think is,
yeah,
I think that's a bit of a secret weapon too.
Absolutely, I use that one.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner and tell us what that book is about so that we can follow along.
Yes. So the founding question of economics is this question that Adam Smith, the Scottish philosopher, asked in his very big book from 1776 called The Wealth of Nation. And the founding question of economics is, how do you get your dinner? And that's actually a very good economic question, because we take it for granted that we can go to the store and there will be things to buy there and somebody who will sell us stuff and it will be open and they will accept our money and so on and so on. But actually, for this to happen, just a simple loaf of bread to be there on a shelf in the store, lots of very complex economic processes need to take place. So Adam Smith was interested in what makes all of this work. How does this really, really complex economic system, you just keep going? And his very, very, very famous answer to this founding question of economics, how do you get your dinner, was, it's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that you get your dinner. It's from them serving their own self-interest. So we do what we do. We go to work every day because we want to make money and we want to serve our own self-interest. And from that, economics basically became the science of self-interest. And when you talk about thinking like an economist, it's often analyzing a situation, looking at the different players and why do they do what they do, based on their self-interest. And some people took it further and talking about greed is good. If everybody just goes out and sort of tries to make as much money as they can, then magically this is going to become the best of all worlds. And that is, to a large extent, what economics became, or standard economic theory. What I do in the book is I add women to this story. So, okay, the founding question of economics is, how do you get your dinner? How did Adam Smith, the founding father of economics, get his dinner? The answer to that question is that he lived most of his life with his mother, who looked after the household for him so that he could write his big books on economics. So she is the part to the answer to this founding economic question that he forgot. And this has led to, for example, most of the unpaid work that women are still expected to do to a larger extent around the home, cooking and cleaning and looking after children, is still not counted as work in economic theory. It's not part of GDP. It's basically invisible to economic statistics still, which gives us a very skewed picture of what the economy is. But also, I think it makes us misunderstand what drives people, because it's not just self-interest. I mean, you know that, Stacey, obviously. But Adam Smith's mother, she was not like the butcher, the brewer, or the baker. She didn't just look after her son his whole life because of self-interest. Maybe partly. She was a widow in Scotland in the 1700s, so she couldn't, go do many other things. But I think it's also fair to assume that she did what she did out of love, or because she cared for him, or she felt an obligation. And all of these other reasons to why we do what we do in the economy that economics has frankly not been very good at taking into account. So that's the story, basically, adding women to the story of economics and stirring it around, and then the whole narrative changes.
I love this so much. So a lot of things, ideas came to mind, but I was really thinking about the corporate world. And there's been a lot of push why diversity helps the bottom line, and bringing more women to the executive table clearly helps the bottom line. And in economics, right, it's such an important factor. And yet it still feels like our business case is very challenging. So it feels like, as a woman who's trying to get ahead in their career and trying to present it. Like, can't you see? Can't you see having me at the leadership table would bring you more self-interest as a corporation, right? Would bring you more money, would bring you more financial reward. And so there is a business case for it, and we're able to show the numbers. Yet I think the missing piece is this idea that it's not just self-interest. When women are bringing their whole self to the leadership table and they're really showing up and they're saying, okay, not only am I just going to get to the top because I want to be promoted to make you more money, but I'm actually going to change things around here. I'm going to bring more women up with me, right? Whatever that change might be for them that they want to bring to society. And I think that's such an important factor and motivation for women as they continue to climb. Can you see any of the parallels? I mean, obviously economics and the corporate world. Do you ever speak to that?
Yes, there are parallels. And I think things are changing even in the corporate world. So, I mean, what my book was really criticizing 10 years ago when it first came out in Sweden, and then it's obviously traveled quite far and wide, luckily, but it was this sort of very, very narrow focus on, you know, for example, in economics, on just GDP as a measure of everything that's good in a society. And it's just too narrow. It doesn't show a lot of the work that women do. And I think since economics has been changing, and we sort of measure welfare in different way, and we measure happiness, and there is definitely a movement to change this. And I do see similar things in the corporate world, sort of looking at different metrics and other ways of looking at profit and so on. So I think there's definitely parallels there. There's also this big discussion that we've had since the pandemic, particularly I've noticed America, around care and the value of care. I think during the lockdowns, when many people had to, you know, do their day jobs, their paid jobs, and look after children full time, it really brought this point home that care work is infrastructure. You know, without Adam Smith's mother looking after the household, he couldn't have written The Wealth of Nations. Sort of the economy, the formal economy, rests on this other, I don't know what you want to call it, a love economy or a care economy. And without it, nothing works, which I think many of us saw during the pandemic. And I feel that discussion has sort of come back into the corporate world as well now post, well, we're still not out of the pandemic, but I do get requests to come and talk around these issues. Do you notice this as well?
Yeah, well, I was actually going to say that the shift on who has to be a part of the care economy has really changed. And I think that because the men are being brought home, even just from my own personal experience at school drop-off and things like that, right? It's now it's about 50-50 men doing the work and things like that. And then it's allowing women to step into this role, this more career-focused role, whatever that might be for them. But what was happening, I think, before for women is that there was this idea that they had to do both, right? So they had to be a part of they had to be the caretaker, but then they're also expected to be very fully committed at work. And especially if they want to rise or have more responsibility or anything like that, they were just like, basically the options were to do both. And so a lot of women are like, no, I can't do both. And then of course, the self-interest of family ends up weighing out.
Yeah. And exactly. And that's the point I try to make in that book is that if we don't even measure this, and everybody knows it's unpaid, this work that needs to happen around the home in order to keep a family going. And when people look at this and they have this problem in their individual lives, you know, how do I make all of this work? And what I try to show in this book is that this is not just you and your family and your life where this is a conflict. This is a real economic problem. And the problem is that we don't even count this as work. And it clearly is work, and it's not visible in economic statistics. So how can we have a proper conversation around it? And that's why I think things are changing. And also, I mean, in my own family, my husband is a stay-at-home dad. So he's continuously threatening to write a book, you know, who ironed Katrine Marcel's shirts or something like that. Because that is, you know, but I need to take that, you know, that's, yeah, fair game.
Yeah, I love it. It's great. Oh, wonderful. You have a lot of really great personal stories that happened even before you wrote your first book as a journalist, as a woman in economics. And I'd be wondering if you have any stories that you can share, fuel to your fire, that actually propelled you to write.
No, I mean, there's a lot. I was just reading this week, so this is not a personal story, but I'm still shocked. There's this big forum for economists on the internet called Economics Job Rumors. And there was somebody that did a study on what are the most common words used when discussing female economists on this forum online. And it was, I think it was slut, lesbian, and prostitute.
What?
And the, yeah. And some things I cannot mention on your podcast. And then what were the most common words? And they used AI, I think, to sort of go through this internet forum. What were the most common words used to discuss male economists? And it was things like Nobel Prize, mathematician, and textbook. And I think that just says quite a lot about just, you know, how it is, unfortunately, within economics. So I'm a financial journalist, so I've been in that world. And certainly things have happened to me. I mean, my sort of big story, because it was a turning point for me when I was a young journalist, was when I was going to interview a Nobel Prize winner in economics here in Stockholm in Sweden. And I had studied his work for, you know, I don't know, weeks. And I came down, or I was sitting and he came down and we were going to do the interview. And he just took one look at me and said, "So who wrote your questions?" And when you're, you know, 20 something, there was just, you know, you don't have a good answer to that. And that was one of these experiences that really made me think about authority and how tricky it is to make people perceive you as somebody with authority within this field. And it seems to not matter, you know, how hard you work. And it was really just one of these moments, and also really pissed me off. So I think that fueled me. It fueled me.
So what can we do? Because I feel like sometimes fighting the system is really tough. And again, gives us a third job that we have to do: be successful in our role at home, be successful at work, and fight the system, right? So what can we do?
Well, I think we do need to fight the system. But I mean, unfortunately,
talk more about fighting the system. Now we're on that. What do you mean? Like, I want to hear.
Right. No, I mean, I do think that it's, I mean, even just my experience with my little book that I wrote in my 20s, and it was much more controversial when it came out. I gave a talk on it in 2015, because that was when it came out in the UK. So I was at London School of Economics in London, and there were these male economists in the room, and they were really, I mean, I remember it as if they were really shouting at me. They might not have been shouting at me, but they were really disagreeing with this message, and you can't do this, and la, la, la. And that was in 2015. And I think if I went back to London School of Economics today, it would have been completely different, which doesn't have anything to do with me or my book specifically, but I do think the discourse and the debate has changed. You know, it's not okay in the same way to say, no, we shouldn't include women in economic statistics. It has shifted. And I have seen that just because, you know, I've followed this book I wrote around. So things do change. And I
think this just reminded me of something. I just thought, okay, so that same shift is happening in the corporate world, right? So nobody in their right mind would say, no, we don't want women on the leadership table. But what they do say is, we don't have any qualified candidates.
Yeah.
Right. That is such a common, and it's completely ridiculous. And this is what my mission is to show women how they can show that they're qualified candidates, right? To put themselves in front of them. So in that sense, right. So yeah, maybe they're not saying it out loud. But when you know, is there anything else that you're noticing that's kind of still there? Those stereotypes, right? Obviously in this internet forum that just came out this last week or whatever, right? That's still very obvious. So it's all right there in front of us, but what else? What's kind of happening? Maybe this possibly leads into what the individual can do for themselves.
Well, Well, I'll tell you something depressing first, Stacey.
Okay, fine. Yeah, okay. I wanted to keep it real.
Well, first, I mean, so it sounds like you're definitely fighting the system. So that's good. Well done. But secondly, the depressing thing I want to say, so I am Swedish, which I've probably already mentioned about five times. And Sweden is a country famous for gender equality policy. So we have a lot of the things that women, for example, in the US really want. You know, there is maternity leave and paternity leave and affordable childcare and all of these things. I think Sweden invests 4% of GDP into systems like this, and they're very, very good because they basically pay for themselves, because when you invest in caring infrastructure, you get more women in paid work and they pay taxes. So the system pays for itself. It's very clever, and it leads to things like, if you're here in Stockholm, you see, you know, a lot of men pushing babies around in broad daylight, which you do not get in that many other parts of the world.
Berkeley, California.
That is correct. My sister studied there. That's correct.
Yeah, exactly. That's where I am. So I'm like, yes, I see it.
Yeah, I see them. Yes. It's a whole country like that. No, but people react to that. But the depressing thing is, actually, women in leadership positions, the US is doing better than Sweden. And so is the UK, which is interesting, isn't it? You have more women in senior management in the US and UK than in Sweden. So what that means to me is that it's much more complex. It's not just, you know, because people are screaming for affordable childcare and maternity and paternity leave and dads looking after babies. And we have all of that in Sweden, and still we don't get women into leadership positions, particularly in the corporate world, which to me is, you know, it's depressing, but it also shows that this is a complex thing, women in leadership, and nobody has really solved this problem. And I think there's just, we need to just attack it from many different angles. Did that really depress you?
No, I can't say it depressed me. I love kind of getting to the heart of what's happening and looking at the, you know, the numbers and the statistics, because it's really important for us to see this right in front of us and to know what's happening. So,
But there was a question in there somewhere that I didn't answer.
I was just wondering if there's anything that the individual can do, because I love that you personally are tackling this gigantic problem, right? And so you know that your work is one small piece of what can be done, and amazing if it changed the whole system, for sure, right? You know, that would be amazing. But yet you choose to do it anyway. And so on the individual level, what is the work that we can do for ourselves to either to speak up, to share, to put ourselves in these positions if that's what we want to do? Anything that comes to mind in that way?
Something that I am passionate about is more women speaking up when it comes to economics and those issues. And I think there are so many male business leaders, for example, or men in corporate who also participate in, you know, to a larger extent than women in that discussion about, you know, the economy and what should we do and where is it going. And I think women are still not doing that very much. And I think women are obviously discouraged from speaking up on those issues. I think as a woman, it's more acceptable to, they saw that, I think they've seen that in the Financial Times, which is a big business paper in the UK where I live, where they looked at people who wrote into the paper, and that women will do it if they have a personal experience that somehow sort of applies to whatever is being discussed, but they do not write in with an opinion about the economy. You know, I am in this field of business and therefore I think we should. And I think that is a very big problem, because it's such a male-dominated field and area of debate. So that is something that I would really love for more women to do. And what I try to do with my books is also just take economics and show that it really is, you know, it's just a language. It's not rocket science, and bring it down. And it's something that is very important that we all participate in, I think, this discussion.
I just had this idea, because I'm often noticing that when women do speak up, it's in these women's forums, right? Yeah. So they'll do it at, you know, a women's leadership forum, or they'll, you know, they'll have these deeper conversations. But I can't imagine that there's too many women economic forums. And so I'm wondering if maybe this is a happy accident for you, that the only way you could speak up is in the more public forums, like in these mixed gender forums or 90% male forums, whatever that might be for you, because that's what exists. But I think for women, and I'm so grateful for women's leadership and that we've created these outlets for women, but that is a challenge because we feel like we've done our work and we're like, oh, I spoke up or I attended this event or I had this conversation, but it's not actually infiltrating the greater population. It's sort of still staying within our own little tiny world that feels safe.
Yeah. We need women to redefine leadership and redefine power and redefine what the corporate world is and should be. And this sounds like a very big to-do list for women, but I do think that is what needs to happen, because all of these things, and that's what I try to do with my books, is just show that it's not just you, it's this whole system. And some people find my books quite, particularly my latest one, Mother of Invention, which is about women and innovation, find that very depressing because, you know, you tell the whole story about innovation and how women have been excluded from that and how technology keeps getting defined as whatever men do and how that pushes women out. And I do that in order to show that, hey, it's not just you. It's, you know, it's 2,000 years of history or more. And it's this big sort of structural problem. But many people do find that depressing because it makes it seem like, oh, it's so much to do. It's such a big beast to fight. So that is, I guess that is a problem, but it's also the truth, you know, the reason why women, you know, find it hard, for example, or find it harder to get into leadership positions all over the world is because leadership and power, it's all been defined based on men. So we need to change the definitions and change the norm and do so much. But I do think in the end, it's going to be worth it because it is creating a better world for everyone, not just women.
What if we go back to this idea of self-interest, right? Full circle. And I was thinking about the woman who is, you know, challenged by, it's really difficult to fight the whole system, right? Add one more thing to my plate, you know, all of this. But truthfully, I see time and time again, when a woman, one single woman gets herself just this from a self-interest standpoint, like, you know, I think it would be great to make a salary of 400,000 base comp. And I'm going to ask for it. And that is based in somewhat self-interest.
Yes.
Yet that self-interest is changing the system, right? That one thing that you can do.
Yeah. And that is such an important point, which I should have mentioned earlier, actually, but self-interest, because economics became the science of self-interest and women were excluded from that. And part of that was also that women are not allowed to be greedy. Women are not allowed to, you know, serve their own self-interest. You know, men should be out in the formal economy, make the money, and greed is good. And that should all be based on this female self-sacrifice, unpaid labor that just happens and nobody has to measure it or think about it or think about how to incentivize it. So women were also shut out from self-interest. So part of actually breaking down the system is also allowing women to be, you know, to act in their own self-interest to a larger extent than they have been allowed to do historically. Yes. And yes, I probably should have mentioned that earlier.
Love it. Oh my God. That's beautiful. So tell us about your latest book. I know it's now available in the US and I, you know, we'll link to it in the show notes, but how did this book come about?
Oh, so it's called Mother of Invention, How Good Ideas Get Ignored in an Economy Built for Men. And well, it starts with the story of the rolling suitcase. So we invented the wheel 5,000 years ago. And since then, we have applied the technology of the wheel to lots of things. We have cars and bikes and hamster wheels and, you know, whatnot. But there is one very famous exception to this rule that many economists have talked about, which is suitcases. So we didn't get wheels on suitcases until 1972. That's the first successful patent for a suitcase with wheels. So that is after we put two men on the moon. And this is this classic mystery of innovation. You know, how come that this invention, which should have been so obvious, right? You know, take this 5,000-year-old technology of the wheel and apply it to the problem of carrying a heavy suitcase. Voila, you know, clearly product that will disrupt the whole global luggage industry. Still, it didn't happen. And there's been lots of explanations to why. The real reason is it has to do with gender, which is what I found out and which is why I start the book there. There were actually suitcases with wheels well before 1972, but they were all niche products for women. And as these niche products for women, nobody took them seriously or invested in them or thought they could be anything that disrupted a whole global industry. And there was this really, really strong assumption that from the industry that no man would ever roll a suitcase because it's unmanly. A man has to carry. The luggage industry thought, well, women might buy this suitcase with wheels, but women are too small of a market because women don't travel alone. If a woman travels, she obviously does it with a man, and he then has to carry her suitcase for her. And this is actually, these sort of really gendered assumptions was what delayed this innovation that we now take for granted. And even after the rolling suitcase was invented, at first no American department store wanted to sell it. So it really, really took a long time. And it was a very, very strong gendered resistance. So I start the book there, and the book is full of these stories about how innovations that we now take for granted were held back or delayed because of gender bias. Electric cars, for example, were around already in the 1800s, but they were marketed to women and product developed with women in mind. So male consumers didn't want them. And so the history of innovation is full of this. And so I wrote a book about it. And it's trying to show and explain, you know, what we are missing by not including women more, particularly when it comes to innovation.
That's awesome. I love it. I love your storytelling. And they're also such vivid stories and really just like makes me want to take action. I'm like, what? You know? What? And sometimes I actually find myself in today's society, my husband will be like, we need to roll this. He wants to buy the $5 card at the airport and, you know, pile everything up, not carry everything himself. And then here I am with six bags and a baby on my hip, you know, like really? Actually carrying everything.
Oh, you're strong.
Well, you know, yeah, I have to show. So yeah. We've touched on this. Obviously, the whole conversation has really been to this, but I think it's worth asking again. Why do you personally feel motivated to have a seat at the table, to have a voice in this conversation, whatever that seat looks like for you?
I don't know. I think I just can't help myself. I mean, sometimes I just wish, don't you? Sometimes you just wish that you could just
be easier.
Yeah exactly. Right. On yourself and everyone around you. But somehow it's what's meaningful. And I've always been a bit difficult and, you know, in a good way, I like it. And I like to challenge things. And I think that's just who I am. I don't know, blame my parents, I guess.
Good on them. Yeah, it's great. So before we go today, do you have any words of advice for a woman who's been struggling to advance her career, feels like she can see all of the politics around her, the gender bias, but still is having trouble getting to that next level? Do you have any words of advice for her?
Well, this is what, that will be the same thing that makes people find my books depressing, which is it's not just you, it's the whole system, it's 2,000 years of history, it's all the institutions, they're not built for people like you. So it's not personal, but you know, I find that there's a message of hope in that. And I like to think like that, and clearly, and I write my books like that, to sort of put things like that, individual struggles that people have, into this larger context. But other people do find that depressing. But yeah, I guess something along those lines would be my...
Well, that's why I wanted to bring you on here, because it's not personal. And I think we spend a lot more time having the conversation about imposter syndrome than we do about history and what's happening in the world. And that's the conversation I want to be having. It's like, you know what, actually, let's just assume assume it has nothing to do with you. And then you get to decide if you want to advance from your own self-interest, and that's okay. And really, how do we get more and more comfortable with that in and of ourselves, and to be able to just take the steps necessary for whatever life we want to create for ourselves?
I agree. And I mean, particularly my latest book was on women and innovation. And, you know, as I mentioned, and I have thought a lot about, you know, why it seems so hard for women. And when I'm out speaking on these issues, you know, to in corporate settings and other types of settings, it's, you know, a lot of organizations have this problem that, you know, women just don't step forward and, you know, say, you know, I'm an innovator, or I have an idea. And when they have structures, internal incubators that people can apply to, they find that, you know, mainly men apply. And obviously, when you look at things like venture capital, it's, you know, men basically have a monopoly in all of that. There's a real problem. But then you start reading history and you find, you know, you see how difficult we have made it for women to see themselves as innovators. You know, women basically invented software. Today, every, you know, the most valuable companies in the world are all software companies. Many people don't even know that this is basically a female invention. And other, you know, brilliant female innovators, this woman, she's not in the book, but somebody I studied who invented modern mobile phone technology, more or less. And she never saw herself as an innovator. And you think, well, you invented modern mobile phone technology and you still can't say the word, you know, she couldn't. I mean, she, you know, I'm an inventor, I'm an innovator. We make it so hard for women. And it's this whole history of why that is the case. And I think knowing that history and knowing why that is, I think that can probably or hopefully help people to see, no, it's not me having some imposter syndrome that has to do with something in my background. It's not you, it's the system. And I think that is just a much more accurate picture of how things stand. And then when you know how things stand, you can make a decision, just as you say.
Yes.
What are you going to do?
You know, one of the lessons that I learned for overcoming gender bias is to surround yourself with imagery of people overcoming gender bias, right? Just different. And I just saw a series of post-it notes that were like, you know, on my screen, which was like, women invented software. Like, you know, like just so you know, and just reminding ourselves that we are innovators and this is the work that we did. And we've also have a history of that work. Yes, it might not be recognized publicly, but that we do have a history there.
Yes, all this to make the important point that reading my books is not depressing, no matter what people say.
I love it. I think everybody should read your book. Speaking of, where can we learn more about you and follow you? And I'll link to everything in the show notes as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, so firstly, you should read my books because my books are better than me. But I have a website, katrinemarcel.com, and you can sign up to my newsletter.
Oh, her newsletter is so good. It's actually, don't call it a newsletter. What is it called? You call it something else. Is it a newsletter?
Well, it's called The Wealth of Women. Is it a newsletter?
It's just It feels beyond newsletter. This is journalistic excellence that comes into my inbox. And it's really amazing.
Thank you. It's called The Wealth of Women. So, I'd love for you to sign up to that. And in my books, it's Who Cooked Adam Smith's Dinner? And the other one is called Mother of Invention.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Me. Oh, Katrine, thank you so, so much for being here. This has been such a lovely chat, and I'm so appreciative, as I know everybody listening is as well.
Thank you.
Before you go, I want to invite you to join us inside of Executive Ahead of Time. Executive Ahead of Time is what I call my little army of corporate badasses that are doubling the number of women promoted to the executive suite each and every year worldwide. Inside this group coaching intensive program, where you get weekly coaching and guidance from me, you are going to learn how to not only land your next promotion, but to have success once you get there. And by success, I mean an actual voice at the table, the ability to step into your true, authentic, corporate badass self, and a community of other corporate badasses where we're learning from each other, challenging each other, and stepping in to that next level of leadership. If this sounds exciting to you, I invite you to join us now at www.executiveaheadoftime.com. Once you enroll, you will have lifetime access to over 24 core training modules where I break down step by step how to build trust with executive leadership so that you get tapped on the shoulder for opportunities. You'll receive weekly coaching and directed guidance from me, and we'll have roundtable discussions with the other corporate badasses in the group. This is a community like nothing that you have ever experienced. We are all challenging each other. We are stepping up to the plate, and we're making opportunities happen for ourselves. Go to executiveaheadoftime.com and join us today.